Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming advice, recipes and opinions, and we come here once a week, here, live, at noon, live, Donna, at noon, at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in downtown Ames, Iowa, the center of Ames, the center of Iowa, the center of it all. Oh, spring. Donna, I saw you at Farmer's Market this Saturday.
Oh, hooray, hooray, the Farmer's Market. There weren't a lot of vegetables. I think I did buy bok choy, scallions, lots of baby plants for sale.
Oh, good.
What else did you get?
I assume there was asparagus, although I didn't get there early.
Very early. Like Kate said, they sold out right away because there's not a lot of it.
And the amount of people there just walking up and down and being civil to one another, it was such a fun thing. There's
plenty of meat vendors. Our favorite cheese farmer, Kevin, was back.
And they had a petting zoo. I have plenty of animals to fool with at my own farm, but little animals are cute, especially when they come in the small variety. You know, these were the breeds that are made to be small. There was a tiny cow, believe it or not.
Oh, I didn't see it.
It wasn't
a calf. It was a...
No, it was a cow. It was dark red with a white face sort of, and I looked at the business end and it was a young heifer, but it was short, kind of like
I've seen in, actually in France, in Brittany, I saw, it looked like a teeny weeny Holstein, about the size of a, not much bigger than a Shetland pony, and it is a milking cow.
Yeah, it is, it is. So,
I want one of those.
Apropos of that, we're going to be talking about cows today and other animals that give us milk. And, Donna, we got a rain. We got a rain, and we have needed it here in central Iowa. The grass is greening up. The trees are going crazy. And because the grass is greening up, the ruminants are happy. The ruminants that make their living eating grass. It's a good time to be a cow, Donna.
Well, and this brings up why we're going to talk about milk today. In some traditions, the full moon, which we just had last Friday, is called the milk moon. In some traditions, it's also called the flower moon. But the milk moon in traditions that have dairy herding, because what happens, and you can all imagine this, if the cows have been, you know, kind of confined for the winter, you know, to protect them and feed them because the grass is all covered in snow and it's cold out. When the new grass starts to come, they're looking over the fence longingly. And I've heard dairy farmers tell about the first day that they let the cows out into the grassy field, that they dance, they frolic, they are ecstatic.
Oh, how wonderful.
And in traditional dairying cultures like, I was reading in this book about the Celtic culture, which had a dairying, you know, on Beltane, the Celtic people left their winter homes and drove their herds up into the summer pasture.
Ooh.
And this is also true in Alpine cultures. Any place with mountains will do that. And in the Himalayas, the same thing, that, you know, as the snows melt and it gets warm, it makes really good grass, and the spring grasses are particularly nutritive for the cows. I mean, these old ancient cultures that really were the foundation of dairying, you know, when humans started milking animals and herding them and breeding them, and, you know, it's not like the kind of dairy that we have now. It was still... Anyway, this is the basis for the dairy culture that we have now. And the milk produced was then turned into cheeses and butters and things that they could store and eat all winter long because it was a major part of their diet. You know, it wasn't, it's just like, you know, they grew some vegetables and canned them too, but they also prepared for those long winters by aging their cheeses and you know, processing their dairy in ways that made it last a long time, because this time of year is when the most healthy, like think of that story, Heidi. Now, we all grew up with the Heidi story,
oh,
right?
Heidi, yes.
Okay, so, and her grandfather, her grumpy grandfather, lived in the mountains and milked his cows. And so when Heidi was sent to the city to stay with Clara, right, the wealthy but unhealthy young girl, eventually Heidi took Clara back to Grandpa in the mountain, and Grandpa fed Clara the raw milk, and Clara became healthy.
Was it cows or goats or sheep? I don't remember.
I don't remember, and it kind of doesn't matter. It depends on what the animals were eating.
That's true. It was the spring thing.
It was the healthy
spring thing.
Grass that was so good that Clara became healed. You know, I mean, that's a story we all grew up with and love. And what they're talking about is a fundamental way that not just cows, but goats, to some extent, cheese from sheep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are a lot of animals you can milk.
Yeah, that's good.
And so that is what dairy products originally came from. Then along came, like, the Industrial Revolution, right? Okay, so things started happening. You know, when people were living more in cities and couldn't, you know, they were not shepherds. They were not having their own cows or contributing to the village herd, and milk had to be stored longer, and cows moved closer into civilized areas. So here's the problem with people and animals. The more densely concentrated you have them, there's more poop, there's more contamination, the bacterial loads go up. It's harder for humans and for animals to be healthy. So, of course, milk is a very volatile it's a product that is rich in food for all kinds of bacteria. The good bacteria that make cultured milk products, the good bacteria that make cheeses, but also the ones, you know, like Listeria, which can kill you, right? So milk it's subject to a lot of laws, and for very good reasons, right? And that have to do with cleanliness and the way herds are managed. And, you know, now we have dairy herds that are thousands of cows.
And we're kind of running across the same thing again. All these animals together. And
it's complicated.
There's a whole lot of poop generated, and there's a whole lot of problems.
And obviously it can be done, but, you know, antibiotics are used a lot, and all kinds of other management skills that do not necessarily, they create a safe product, but maybe not necessarily as nutritious as milk used to be, right? And then you bring up, one of the reasons we decided to do this show today is that Iowa has just passed, through the Iowa legislature, a raw milk bill. So finally, many states around Iowa have allowed the sales of raw milk for a long time. Not in Iowa at all, zero. For example, California has a very large, I mean, not compared to regular milk, but, you know, industrial-sized herds producing and selling raw milk. And they do it in California. The law does it by really closely monitoring the bacterial count of the product. Mm-hmm. Makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if the bacteria is too high. Well, but they can't sell it as raw milk. But the inverse also happens is, since you pasteurize, which means heat, right? The reason you pasteurize is to kill the bacteria. Now, you end up killing the good bacteria as well as the bad bacteria, but you kill everything, which means no one will get sick from it. So, in California, they just simply monitor the bacterial counts, which means in highly processed milk, you can have much dirtier, higher bacterial levels in your milk that you're selling, because you know it's going to be heated and killed, right? So a raw dairy, in fact, has to be much cleaner, which is one of the reasons why I always thought that was a good idea, because it means at the farm gate, you have to have cleaner, healthier animals, or they will not produce milk that has a low enough bacteria count to be sold as raw milk. Well, in Iowa, they're not dealing with that at all. The new law is, and I believe it's not just cow milk, it did say dairy animals, so it probably includes goats. If you have more than 10 animals, you cannot, so it keeps it really, really small. You can only have 10 animals to, you know, like Kevin, our cheesemaker friend, has too many animals, too many cows, because he's making cheese, to be able to sell raw milk. So, and the other restriction, major restriction, is it cannot be sold at farmers' milk markets or any commercial outlets. You must go directly to the farm to buy it. So that's the law that we have. I don't, at this point, know anybody that's, you know, there probably are people in the state that will be able to do that. No, nobody that I know of in this area. It will, however, create the opportunity for maybe some smaller or beginning farmers who might want to take on that market. I mean, it is very limited.
That's true. But if I was talking to Kevin, too, the cheesemaker, and he said, well, you know, if you're just getting started and you want to learn about cows and you want to learn about goats and, you know, 10 cows, it may not be a huge operation, but it's a good way to start. So maybe in a roundabout way, the Iowa law has opened things up for a new market for beginning farmers.
Well, the impetus, I'm sure, in the legislature, you know, was that, okay, this is another marketing opportunity for smaller farmers, which is great. You know, whatever they use to pass the law, bravo. We'll see what happens. I used to have a milking goat, which was, you know, in my adult life. I mean, I grew up in dairy farms and stuff, but my adult life was like in California. And for my children, I thought, oh, this is fun. Let's, you know, managing a cow is a big deal. They produce a lot of milk. Even a goat produces a lot of milk. I think I was getting, oh golly, maybe 3 quarts a day, sometimes more, sometimes less, you know. And if you are dairying, you have to milk once or twice a day, depending on the animal and the levels of production. So, you know, you end up with a lot of milk. And I was making yogurt. I was making simple cheeses. And we really enjoyed it, and it was a lot of fun. But if you get bigger than goats or a goat, it you know, it becomes like, should we milk your sheep, Lana?
If you can get them to stand still. Well, actually, during a lambing process, a friend of mine, we were forced to milk the mother goat to get her started, and. Mm-hmm. Boy, oh boy, that's a process. Because we're not used to being milked.
Yeah, they have to be trained. And with my goat, for example, I had a little stanchion. It was up on she jumped up on a shelf that was maybe 2 feet high. And then I put a thing around her neck that made her stay in one place. And then I gave her some food so she would, you know, that she knew if she jumped up there, she would get fed. And then I had my little stool, and you know, since goats are short, having her up higher helped me. So I sat on my little stool, and sometimes she would kick the bucket, sometimes she would put her foot in the bucket, you know, and then we didn't drink that. But I really enjoyed it. And milking is, oh, it's hilarious. You know, you have to, there's a certain way you have to press on the teats to draw the milk down. You don't just like squeeze. It's a thing where you kind of roll your fingers down it. Yeah. And once you learn to do it, it's very relaxing. I really like it.
You have to pretend you're a little calf or a little goat.
Well, here you are leaning into the belly of this big warm old animal and, you know, squeezing the milk out of her, and she knows you, so she lets you do that, and it's a relationship. And it is really pleasant. So now the thing is, of course, most cows these days don't have that kind of,
Shall we call it a hands-on experience?
Right. Even in the 50s and 60s, when I was around my uncles, who had, of course, milking machines, still you had to affix the milk. You had to get the cow in the stanchion. And, I mean, my uncles all ran about herds of between 25 and 50, I think, was kind of the standard. Mm-hmm. So they were milking maybe 30 cows or something on a regular, and the cows all knew their places. You open the gate, they come into the barn because they know they're going to be fed a treat, and they want to, you know, have their udders empty too. At this point, they've come back from the fields, and they get in the stanchion, and then somebody has to go clean the udders off with a, you know, some kind of disinfectant so there's no poop or something on it. Then you hang up this big heavy milking machine, and you have these suction things that you put one on each tit, and then it, you know, it milks the cow. Now there are robotic milking stations, right?
When I first heard about robotic milking, I thought, what is the world coming to? But I guess if you, again, big money investment, big.
Well, yeah, because you use less labor milking the cows, and farm labor is very expensive and hard to come by these days. There are, you know, the problem that I would think as a farmer in cleaning the cow's udder usually twice a day and affixing the thing, that's also a way to inspect them. You know, you're looking for mastitis, which is an infection of the udder, and which can, you know, if you milk a cow with mastitis, whatever, depending on the infection, that can put that hole into your, you know, because all the milk is collected from all the cows, goes through tubes into a big tank, but it can up your bacterial levels in your milk and cause contamination. So anyway, there must be a way where they're watching. You know, you're checking the health of the cows essentially twice a day this way.
It's true, unless it's part of a computer test too. I don't know.
I don't know either, way more modern than I have any experience with.
Talk about cows being able to learn new tricks. They, you know, learn to get into this robotic thing that kind of does the same thing that, well, that originally hands did or a baby calf did.
Yes.
Ooh, pretty amazing. Pretty
well,
amazing.
Well, you know, there are lots of cultures that are milk-based. A lot of northern Europeans, less mm-hmm. southern Europeans, of course, India, Tibet, some of the African tribes are very, you know, the herding tribes are like the Maasai are very, geared into, you know, milk is the staple. I mean, the thing is you can, if you're growing the cows for meat, if it's, you know, because there are dairy cattle and there are meat cattle, right? Mm. And you can eat the dairy cattle too, but it's sort of like killing the golden goose. If you eat your dairy cattle, it's not making milk anymore. So, right. You know, this is a whole herding thing. So lots and lots of traditions for culturing milk and preserving it. Lana has a list here.
It's a list of different animals around the world that people get milk from. It's not, well, we think of cows and goats, perhaps. Here we go.
Not pigs, by the way.
Oh, no. Well, now really, all the, we're talking lactating, but these are animals
mammals.
That
it's
people
mammals,
get milk
yeah.
from. Mammalian mamas. It lists Jersey cows, and I suppose all the other kind of cows that we use, but also La Mancha goats, Saracatan sheep, Berkshire horses, huh?
Well, that's right. Horse milk is a thing in some Asian
Ooh.
Cultures, yeah.
Kachichi camels, huh?
Camel milk, right.
Reindeer, Donna.
Yeah.
Water buffalo.
Oh, water buffalo milk is really good.
Well, I never have had that.
Well, I've had it in India, but it's also a big, like water buffalo mozzarella. It's a big thing
right.
in Italy.
This must be in India, or I mean an African thing. Zebu cows, yaks,
mm-hmm.
and Koli Watsui cows, huh? Zomo yaks crossed with cattle. There's something called a Nadama cow and a Nigerian dwarf goat. That's some of the things. I'm interested. I've never had mare's milk, but evidently you can milk horses.
Apparently, it's not terribly high in fat.
Well, all right. So you want your low-fat
milk? I've heard
milk?
That it's slightly bluish. No, it's not blue. But they mean mm-hmm. it means it's not rich in butter fat for some.
Well, it takes but all kinds. It
actually, yesterday we were at Practical Farmers of Iowa, and who was the goat-raising lady? Margaret Chamas raises goats, and she was talking about, we were talking about the raw milk law, and she said people are buying her raw goat's milk in Missouri, where the law has been in effect a little longer, and people particularly are buying it. She has a customer that buys it because she has a little baby horse, a foal, that was orphaned. So they're feeding goat's milk to the orphan. And I had heard that before, that goat's milk is kind of the universal feeding orphaned animals.
Oh.
Because it's highly digestive, and apparently the protein globules in the milk are smaller and more digestible than cow's milk, for example.
Milk is pretty amazing stuff.
Yeah. We're going to go into a whole bunch of more things about milk. Do we need a station break first?
Not yet.
Oh, okay. All right.
You start.
I'm going to launch into my list then here. Okay. Now, when you're buying milk, and this is, you know, we are in the current modern market, and you go to the grocery store, you have options, a frightening amount of options. And if you don't know what these mean, then you're not choosing to the best of your ability. So here are some words that you need to know. You'll see on a carton, of course, all the milk that we sell in the grocery store in Iowa is pasteurized. Okay, pasteurization is a heat process. It's what you have to do to make it not raw milk, and it's done to kill off the bacteria, right? Okay, so, but there's two kinds of pasteurization. One is called ultra pasteurization, and the other one is called low temp pasteurization. There used to only be low temp pasteurization, which is, let's see, I think you heat it to a certain temperature, which is much lower, but you hold it a little bit longer. Now, ultra pasteurized, I don't particularly like it, because to me the milk tastes cooked, which it is. It's a much higher pasteurization temperature, and the reason milk companies like it is because with the ultra pasteurized, it has a much longer shelf life, which means it can sit on the shelf in the grocery store cooler for, you know, probably three or four times as long as the low temp pasteurization milk. Okay, so that's one choice that you have to make. I choose to buy the low temp pasteurization milk because I like the flavor. Now, granted, I grew up drinking a lot of different kinds of milk. My father was always tasting different milks. We'd go anywhere and we'd try this dairy and that dairy, and oh, what does this mean? And so I have a rather developed dairy palate. I'm not a great wine taster, but I am an excellent milk taster.
Right? Keep that in mind.
Okay.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. So I prefer the low temp pasteurized milk. The rest of it tastes cooked to me and is a little flatter in flavor. So, and almost all of the dairy, certainly all of the A&E milk and all of that kind of thing is ultra pasteurized. And it will have to say on the carton, you know, I tend to buy, for that reason, I buy the Kelowna dairy milk, which we have a lot of places. It is an Iowa company, and they do use low-temp pasteurization. So, okay, that's your first choice, to ultra-pasteurize or low-temp pasteurize. The next thing is homogenization, okay? Okay, homogenization. Okay, in milk, out of the cow, the cream rises to the top, which is how you get butter. And the fat content of the, you know, whether you have 2% whole milk, da 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 da. It has to do with how much, in almost all dairies, a good amount of fat is removed and used for butter making. That commands, and in fact, even when my grandfather's day, the milk was they would sell the cream separately. That was the valuable part of the milk. And in some dairies and in some cultures, really more affluent ones, the dairy fats are what are saved. It's turned into cheese. It's turned into butter. And some places what's left over is actually fed for pig. It's called whey. Right. Well, whey is slightly different. It's the after product.
Oh,
of,
that's right. That's
some
right.
of the proteins are moved. But yes, so homogenization is where they take whatever percentage of the fat they want to leave in the milk, whether it's 2% or whole milk, and they force it through some kind of membrane that makes the fat globules small enough that it stays in the whole, the body of the milk. Whereas if you buy unhomogenized milk, it's called, some places they call it cream top, where the cream is still sitting on the top of the milk. And, again, Kelowna also, they do low temp pasteurization and they don't homogenize it. Now, milk is a funny thing. It's what you get used to.
That's true.
You know, like my grandson, for example, he won't drink the unhomogenized milk because he thinks it's yucky to have the milk separate like that. He doesn't want those fat globules in his milk. He will only drink homogenized milk. And a lot of people are that way because predominantly milk on the market is homogenized and ultra pasteurized. Like I have some friends who they think the low temp pasteurization tastes funny. To me, the other one tastes funny because I am used to really looking at flavor profiles in milk and I don't want it to taste cooked unless I cook it myself, right? Okay. So you have, those are the two common denominators that you have to choose. And the bulk of the milk in the grocery stores will be ultra pasteurized and of course homogenized. So you can, and sometimes it's called UHT. So, okay, we have more distinctions after the break.
More stuff, there's lots to learn. You're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was the Barnall Bland playing a farm-related sort of tune that's called Behind the Haystack. Yes, it is. We're talking about cows today. Donna's got a lot to say about milk.
Milk, milk, milk. Okay, so I often make a joke that I have been at milk made many lifetimes.
Yes,
I just love milk. So, We did mention that Iowa now has a new law about you can buy, in certain very restricted instances, you can buy raw milk. Now, before, it was completely against the law to buy raw milk. However, there's a different set of laws for raw milk and cheeses. So I'm going to read this little thing. It's from a thing called the Spruce Eats. It's about cheeses. Raw milk cheeses made with milk that is unpasteurized, raw milk cheeses may be firm, oozy, creamy, or crumbly, and they can come in any shape. They are always made small scale by small scale artisanal producers, and they often come from single herd cow, sheep, or goat milks. And that is because you have to keep the milk really clean.
Ah.
And, you know, as we said, the more cows you have, the harder it is to keep your bacterial counts low. So throughout history, raw milk has been the prime ingredient for great cheeses because of their unique flavor-rich array of well-defined flavors and aromatics. The depth of complexity and the unmistakable sense of uniqueness. We're talking cheeses here. When the milk is cooked or pasteurized, many naturally occurring flavor-rich enzymes and good bacteria are destroyed or denatured by heat, and the cheese loses that important flavor-building foundation. Additionally, raw milk cheese imparts terroir, which means earth, but it also means what the cow ate, right? Different plants in different places. And that wonderful taste of place that has the unique characteristics of the land in which the cheese is made. Okay, since 1949 in the U.S., because this is a federal law, the government has forbidden the sale of cheeses made from unpasteurized milk unless the cheese is aged at least 60 days. The 60-day ban is meant to protect consumers from potentially harmful pathogens, right? After 60 days, the acids and salts in the raw milk cheese naturally prevents Listeria, Salmonella, and E. coli from growing. So you have been able to buy, and you will see in better cheese stores, cheeses that will say raw milk cheese. And there are quite a few, especially imported cheeses. You know, France has a big tradition of these kinds of cheeses. And on the French label, it will say L-A-I-T, which means milk, cru, C-R-U, which means raw. So if it says au lait cru, means made from raw milk. But there are plenty of American cheeses that do that. But mostly they're hard cheeses because they have to be aged for 60 days.
Huh.
So that is a thing to look for on the packaging when you buy your cheeses.
Good stuff to know. There's the animals that give us milk. They're just amazing things because we can do a lot with that milk and that butter fat. We're going to listen to a poem here. And this kind of a Donal on a Kitchen tradition, mainly because
we both like this poem because we grew up with it.
Yeah, it's one of our favorite poems, and it refers to butter, and it also deals with supply and demand and all that sort of thing. And in it, for a long time, I couldn't figure out why the cow in this poem was called not a cow, but an Alderney. An Alderney is a breed of cow in the British Isles, Alderney. And it fits the poem a lot better to say Alderney as opposed to cow. But anyway, this is a poem, and we're going to have a good time listening to it. It's about butter.
The King's Breakfast by A.A. Milne. The king asked the queen, and the queen asked the dairymaid, "Could we have some butter for the royal slice of bread?" The queen asked the dairymaid. The dairymaid said, "Certainly, I'll go and tell the cow before she goes to bed." The dairymaid, she curtsied and went and told the Alderney, "Don't forget the butter for the royal slice of bread." The Alderney said sleepily, "You better tell His Majesty that many people nowadays like marmalade instead." The dairymaid said, "Fancy," and went to Her Majesty. She curtsied to the queen and turned a little red. "Excuse me, Your Majesty, for taking of the liberty, but marmalade is tasty if it's very thickly spread." The queen said, "Oh," and went to His Majesty. "Talking of the butter for the royal slice of bread, many people think that marmalade is nicer. Would you like to try a little marmalade instead?" The king said, "Bother." And then he said, "Oh, dearie me." The king sobbed, "Oh, dearie me," and went back to bed. "Nobody," he whimpered, "could call me a fussy man. I only want a little bit of butter for my bread." The queen said, "There, there," and went to the dairymaid. The dairymaid said, "There, there," and went to the shed. The cow said, "There, there, I didn't really mean it. Here's milk for his porringer and butter for his bread." The queen took the butter and brought it to His Majesty. The king said, "Butter, eh?" and bounced out of bed. "Nobody," he said, as he kissed her tenderly. "Nobody," he said, as he slid down the banisters. "Nobody, my darling, could call me a fussy man, but I do like a little bit of butter to my bread."
I'm picturing King Charles in this because he's been in the news so much, you know.
Oh, what a wonderful thing.
He's our new kingly archetype, so there you go.
Well, more power to him, and I hope he enjoys his butter. There you go. We were talking about cows and milk. What a good thing. Don has been drawing a lot of information here from especially the historical information from a book called Full Moon Feast, Food and Hunger for Connection by Jessica Prentice, and it had a whole
right. She
chapter.
She goes through each month and what the so this is where the milk moon comes in, and then she talks about where that came from and what the moon means. So, it's a fun book that goes throughout the year, and it's gotten me off on my favorite topic, which is milk. Now, when you're at the grocery store, there are a few other things to read on the labels of the milk. Of course, organic is one consideration. Now, there's lots of kinds of organic milk, and some of it's pasteurized, and some of it's homogenized, and some of it's not. But the main distinction with organic, of course, is that, and the organic standards have gotten even stricter in the last few years because they have pasture requirements. You are not allowed to use the organic certification. First of all, of course, the cows have to be fed organic grains and grasses. And, they can't be given antibiotics. They certainly can't be given bovine growth hormones, which almost no one is using anymore. But that was a big deal a few years ago. And you would see on the package, no bovine growth hormones, or BGH it was called. Pretty much hardly anyone uses. It was a hormone that was introduced into dairying to produce even more milk. And then they found out eventually that it kind of exhausted the cows. It wasn't a particularly good thing. And then there was a consumer backlash. People did not want more hormones in their milk.
Because maybe we didn't know where those hormones were going, and maybe
we didn't really need it at all. It wasn't
all
good.
Right.
So you don't have to worry about that too much anymore. But anyway, if it says organic, it means the cows have been on pasture to some extent. It is regulated. They have to be a certain number of days on pasture. And of course that varies by climate. How much pasture you have is not the same in Minnesota as it is in Alabama. But anyway, so organic means that they haven't been exposed to certain pesticides and herbicides and all of that sort of thing. So that, and those products are very clearly marked. It will have the USDA little round green symbol that means it's organic. The other thing that you can look at is it grass-fed? Now, this is the science on it is pretty recent. I'm reading from the Organic Valley website, which kind of clearly, it says, research reveals that Organic Valley grass-fed milk is more nutritious. Now, this pretty much applies to almost all grass-fed milk. New peer-reviewed studies published in the Journal of Food Science and Nutrition reveals that, 100% grass-fed cows. Now, with organic standards, all cows have to have some grass, but to be 100% grass-fed means they are not given grains. It turns out that, yes, cows are meant to eat grass, and when you feed them only grass, they're much healthier, and they produce a different quality of milk. So it says 100% grass-fed cows have dramatically more organic, it changes the fatty acid profile. So omega-3 fatty acids are in the cows that eat mostly grain. Okay, the more grass that cows eat, the more nutrient-rich the milk is. And then, of course, that's passed on to humans. Okay, here are the things that are in conjugated linoleic acid, CLA. Cows that eat grass and no grains produce more conjugated linoleic acid than other cows. So it says here, grass-fed milk has 125% more conjugated linoleic acid. Now, why is that good for you? Because those fats that the cow eats, it's both in the milk and in the dairy, those are considered healthy fats. They do not lead to more artery clogging, higher cholesterol, as much as the other fatty acids. It says the average American diet contains more omega-6 fatty acids than recommended, but the Organic Valley grass-fed milk, and I would say this probably applies to all of the grass-fed milk, has a ratio of 1:1 of omega-3 to omega-6. And it says the science is in, the grass-fed milk is more nutritious. After more than 1,000 samples were analyzed, the science was in whole milk has higher levels of CLA and better omega fatty acids. So this contributes to health benefits, brain health, eye health, and other studies. So anyway, that's another choice that you get to make, whether the cow. Now, all organic milks and lots of milks, cows are grass-fed. Now, are they 100% grass-fed, or are they given other supplemental grains? And that can vary widely. So you have to read that grass-fed label really carefully. And there are certifications for that. For example, there's one called from the American Grass-Fed Association. So if the label says, and this is not, it's not legally regulated, it's a voluntary standard. So you kind of need to know a little about the company that you're buying this grass-fed from. Like Organic Valley has a specific line of totally grass-fed milk, and it says grass-fed on the label. The Kelowna label also says grass-fed. And I think recently I read that the Kelowna milk is using the, on some of their products anyway, the American Grass-Fed Association certification. And there are other certifications too. And this applies for butter as well. So this is just my personal thing. For example, if you have in your family history, like, for example, your father had a heart attack at age 50, okay? That means, or you've been watching your cholesterol levels and they're always high. This is a genetic thing. Some people have to be very concerned about that. If I were a person like that, I would be very careful. This is just my opinion. I would be very careful to eat. Most people just reduce the fats in their diets, which is a good idea for other reasons too. But I would personally, for the fats that I did choose to eat, I would start choosing grass-fed beef and other animals, and specifically milk and butter and cheese, simply because it has a different fat profile, which is better for those considerations of heart health, among other things. So those are things that you can think about when you and read your milk labels, and it's your choice. It depends on, you know, your taste buds, your digestibility, because there's also, there are two other things. There's lactose intolerance, right? Some people have trouble digesting dairy. Now, this could be because they actually, you know, it's a hereditary thing. They have lacking the ability to digest the lactose in milk. It's particularly true of, apparently, in Asian communities and some other people. Northern Europeans usually don't have that problem. However, more and more people do. And some people attribute this to the fact that the modern dairy system is producing milk that is causing some of this because of these confinement operations. So there are two options. You can buy lactose reduced milk, or there's another kind of milk now called A2 milk, which you will also see in the grocery store. A2 is there are two kinds of protein in milks, A2 and A1. So A2 is the oldest, and it's only in the recent breeding history that probably Holsteins and other kinds of breeding have produced a new protein, not that new, but called the A1. So if you have problems digesting milk, you can try the A2 protein. That's what that milk means.
That's what that means.
Yeah.
Very good.
If you see that in the store.
Thanks for the rundown, Donna. Good heavens.
There you go.
You're listening to K2I, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more at www.khoifm.org. Welcome back. We've been talking about milk products. Donna, give us a recipe.
Okay, I got a new one that I'm really happy with. We've talked before about making panna cotta, mm-hmm. And But I have a new recipe. For years I used the Marcella Hazan recipe. And so panna cotta is basically gelatin-based milk and cream, you know. So this recipe is it's a buttermilk panna cotta. But what I like about this recipe is that it uses a little bit less gelatin. So the texture of it is even more like silken, and it's something, if you spray the mold, you can actually unmold it and make it sit on a plate like a piece of Jello and stuff like this. So this is a buttermilk panna cotta from Alice Medrich, who's one of my favorite dessert. She's the queen of chocolate as far as I'm concerned, but she has this book called, it's an older book, Sinfully Easy Delicious Desserts, Quicker, Smarter Recipes, right? So her panna cotta is, you take just a quarter cup of room temperature water and you dissolve the gelatin in that. And she uses powdered gelatin. She only uses 2.5 teaspoons, whereas in the Marcella Hazan recipe, it's about 4 teaspoons. Ah. That makes a difference in the texture of the panna cotta. So anyway, Marcella does not put any water in hers. You dissolve it right on the milk. But this works really smoothly. So you put the gelatin in the water and, you know, you just let it stir it in and you let it sit there and it kind of gloms up in about 5 minutes. So then in a pan on the stove, you heat 1.5 cups of cream. Okay. And when it gets warm, but before it boils, you put the glop of gelatin that's been, and the water, you know, into the cream, and you kind of stir it around and it will dissolve in the warm cream. Do not boil it, okay, but just under a boil. And you can add the sugar there. She uses 1/3 cup of sugar. I don't like mine too sweet, so that's about right. And just a pinch of salt. So then you've got the cream and the gelatin is dissolved. You remove that from the heat completely, and then you add 2.5 cups of buttermilk and kind of stir that in, and you let it go until it gets a little bit thick and comes maybe close to room temperature. Then I just pour mine in little, I have used my little pretty teacups, but you know, you can use a ramekin or an individual, or you can mold it. I have some of those old fashioned Jell-O molds, you know, that kind of thing. Then you just set it in the refrigerator for, I don't know, long enough to, gel.
What, an
3 hours?
3 hours, okay.
Maximum, yeah. You know.
I never quite know. You poke
well,
at it.
Well, you look
see.
At it, and it's, yeah. You know, if it wobbles like a Jell-O, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's a duck, right?
Or it's panna cotta.
Yeah, or yes, it's panna cotta. And then you can just serve it plain. Now, I'm going to use this recipe, and you don't have to do it with buttermilk. I might do it with, so it's a total, so 1.5 cups and 2.5 cups is 4 cups of total dairy in it. So you could do, if you wanted it to be less caloric, you could just put milk in it, or you could make it half and half. Sometimes I just use straight half and half for the amount of milk. And you can flavor panna cottas. You can make them vanilla. You can make them, I sometimes use honey instead of sugar. You can serve them with fruit over them. It's such an easy, easy dessert, and everybody loves it.
And thanks to the cows. Yes, thanks to the cows. Well, thanks for all the good information today, Dan. This is good.
Right. We didn't even talk about making your own butter, making your own yogurt, making your own kefir.
More
there's
to come,
so many things.
Because I can just say the word cows to Donna, and she's off and running. There's so much to talk about. And so we'll do that on a future show. This is good. I'd like to end with a little poem by author and farmer, Kentucky farmer, Wendell Berry. Here's a little bit about farming in general. And when we have all these weather events coming through, yes, the tornadoes may flatten your garage or your school, but it kind of, these things affect the farmers too. And we've got drought, we've got too much rain. But
hail.
Hail. Oh,
yes. Hail the
anyway.
Hail, right?
This is from a collection called The Mad Farmer Poems, and it's Wendell Berry being quite opinionated on things. Here's what he says about a little bit about farming. Don't worry and fret about the crops. After you've done all you can for them, let them stand in the weather on their own. If the crop of any one year was all, a man would have to cut his throat every time it hailed. But the real products of any year's work are the farmer's mind and the cropland itself. If he raises a good crop at the cost of belittling himself and diminishing the ground, he has gained nothing. He will have to begin all over again next spring, worse off than before. Let him receive the season's increments into his mind. Let him work it into the soil. The finest growth that farmland can produce is a careful farmer. Make the human race a better head. Make the world a better piece of ground. From Wendell Berry. So, and I'm sure not only does he put crops in the ground, I'm sure he's got some farm animals.
Yeah, we'll have to keep this in mind while the farm bill is coming up soon. There will be a lot of talk about farming, mostly by people who don't farm and know very little about it.
That's pretty amazing. We talk about robotic farming and things getting more and more mechanized, somehow talking about the fact that dealing with milk animals can be a real hands-on experience. We can forget that we're all part of in this together.
Lon and I are advocating for more and smaller farmers.
Right.
More farmers.
Right. I can't say that I have ever milked anything, but Donna has. So there you go.
No, you told us about milking your sheep.
That was more of a sumo wrestling experience.
Yeah, right.
Okay, good. Well, here's another little bit of wisdom from Wendell Berry. Put your hands in the mire; they will learn the kinship of the shaped and unshaped, the living and the dead. When I rise up, let me rise up joyful like a bird. When I fall, let me fall without regret like a leaf. Sowing the seed, my hand is one with the earth. Wanting the seed to grow, my mind is one with the light. Hoeing the crop, my hands are one with the rain. Having cared for the plants, my mind is one with the air. Hungry and trusting, my mind is one with the earth. Eating the fruit, my body is one with the earth. Let me wake in the night and hear it raining and go back to sleep.
We could do that last night. Oh, boy.
Oh, yes, we had a fine one. Yes, we did. Well, we were talking about milk and cows and a lot of good information today from the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is Community Radio. The Donna Lana Kitchen has been part of this community radio station for about 10 years now. My goodness, yes, we have. And there'll be more to come. So you can tune in next week and we'll talk about all the stuff we didn't get to this week. There you go. So thanks for your support of this radio station. And we have a podcast. Donna, tell them about our podcast.
Yeah, the Donna Lana Kitchen can be found in podcast format. You just go to wherever you listen to podcasts and type in Donna Lana, which is one word, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, Kitchen. And there you will find us.
Yeah. It's pretty much what we hear on the radio, plus a lot of other good things. And we'll have other books to talk about, too, and we'll have other guests.
Other things to cook and eat.
And eat and cook and all that sort of thing. Good. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We come to you live at noon and repeat at 7 p.m. Donna, do you think they can tell this is a live show? I mean, we kind of make things up.
We just stumble along here.
We do, but we do
it's
have a
conversation.
Very good time. And thank you to KHOI and our engineer, Mike Mum, for kind of putting up with us, and we get it on the air and whatever, and support this fine radio station.
We hope
station.
It's useful and inspirational.
We hope so,
and
too.
Entertaining.
And entertaining. We've had music today by the Barn Owl Band. You've heard Behind the Haystack and Banish Misfortune. If you're ever feeling a little down, try saying Banish Misfortune a couple times. It kind of perks you up. Yes, it does. You can listen to this radio program anytime at khoifm.org. You can stream, download, go to our webpage. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Great engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.